Oh yeah! It's another Week of Shop Talk Show, y'all!
Oh yeah! Hello, 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 hello. You're listening to the 13th episode of Shop Talk. This is one of our very, very favorite style of episodes. As you can tell, it's just me, Dave Rupert, and Chris Coyer. Chris?
Hey, folks. Yeah, this is number two of our rapid fire series of shows in which no drama, no links, no guests, just me and Dave with all kinds of, how did Dave put it earlier, question on answer action.
Oh, yeah. Just questions and answers.
I love it. We are going to jump right into it because that's what rapid fire is all about. As many questions as we can answer to catch up a little bit because we love your guys' questions. We want to get through a few more of them than we normally can in an episode. Here is one from Jackson Garrity.
Here we go.
Hello, Shop Talk. My name is Jackson Garrity. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm 15, and I'm a freelance web developer who's super interested in UX design. I've been working on a project recently that uses a separate style sheet for mobile devices. So my question for Shop Talk is, what exactly is everyone's beef with the process of user agent sniffing? And what are the advantages of using CSS3 media queries over it? Is it a viable replacement? Thanks, guys.
Okay, so it sounds like Jackson is... He's got a style sheet that he sniffs out and he injects stuff based on the user agent. He'll like say, oh, use this style sheet instead based on the user agent. Chris, what's everyone's beef?
Okay.
I like how he put that.
But there are people do have beef over this UA sniffing kind of in a big way. Part of the problem with UA sniffing is how often it is incorrect. So I think there's like a new Mozilla browser on mobile devices that just says it's WebKit, just because there's so many user agent sniffing things that if something isn't WebKit, it will just not serve any style sheet or serve a really broken one. So Mozilla's like, that's ridiculous. We're just, in order to get around this kind of huge problem, we're gonna just pretend like we're WebKit. But it's not WebKit, so it may behave differently. So there's problems there. And it's just this never-ending battle, right? How many new devices are there constantly with slightly different user agent strings? It's like this never-ending battle of having to update which UAs you're and you won't keep up with that. You just won't, you know. And so many browsers are lying about it already. They're going to continue to lie about it. There's new ones that aren't lying, but there's tons of different ones. It's just this, like, why do that instead? Why don't you do things like use media queries, which work on all standards devices, and do capability testing, some in the long line of what Modernizer does. Do I have that right? What do you think?
Yeah, no. It's a total arms race. It's like once you support you – one, you have to be like, oh, this, what about this one? And then, oh, what about that one? And then, I mean, like, there's new Firefoxes, like Firefox, whatever, 10, 11, 12, 15, 19. There's new Android devices every, like, 2 weeks. There's Windows phones. There's, like, everything. I mean, you really got to, like, you can't just depend on a user agent. It's kind of the big thing. And it's easy to spoof and... You just can't depend on it. So that's why you probably shouldn't do it.
You're going to do it wrong. You're going to do it wrong. Browsers out.
Like Google does it. Google does it. But they're like they have the smartest engineers on the whole entire planet. So like unless you could be as good at it as Google. And even then they fail. Did you see that article by Brad Frost about how the Google homepage loads on all the Android browsers?
Different is the point.
Yeah, very different, and it's all the Android browser. It's all WebKit. But most of them, some of them are Firefox and Opera. But like, even though it's all the same device and it's the same browser, like, or more or less the same thing,
And the screens, he didn't even pick like tablets and stuff. They were mostly phones, so the screen sizes weren't altogether different.
Yeah, it was just interesting what people like that line in that is user agent sniffing, kind of. That's where it gets you. So that's mm-hmm. a good thing. I wanted to cite this other story I read about how this – saw it on TechCrunch, but this bootstrap startup saves over 100K by dropping IE. And they like dropped Internet Explorer entirely. So basically they're just sniffing for the IE user agent and like boom, saying your browser sucks and like just straight up, which is something I would
– And Opera pretends like it's IE sometime via user agent. So yeah, apparently they've dropped Opera too then, at least
dropped, some older one. Yep. So anyway. They dropped Opera too. But I just find it – I find it interesting. I mean, that would have maybe been something I did like in my youth. Like I would have been just like, I hate this. Boom, you get nothing, you know. But like why would you ever like drop support for like a quarter of the internet? Like IE still is like altogether, if you add them all up, is like the biggest browser in the world still. So like, why would you ever write off the world's most the world's like default browser on the world's most
just
popular operating system
and whatever, which is a tired conversation that we shouldn't let this degenerate to. But do realize that 9 and especially 10, which you know is in pretty much its final version, although it's not actually shipping yet, but you can get it pretty easily, is totally awesome and will not be a problem anymore. The days of us bitching about IE are going to come to a close, and we can move on with more important things like talking about design and accommodating our users and interesting conversations like that.
Cool.
Jackson.
Oh, hold on.
I want to tell you that, if all you're doing is serving a mobile style sheet, do it with media queries. Or if you can't depend on media queries, maybe just measure the browser window width with JavaScript and set your CSS that way. But don't go down the UA sniffing path. It's not going to accommodate you.
Yep. Okay. Boom. Next. The next one's from Peter Bakenthein, and he's asking, what are the 5 most useful CSS tricks you use on various websites? In other words, what 5 CSS tricks can you not live without?
Thanks for your question, Peter. I do want to say that is a tricky question. That this is we're getting to this late. He sent this a number of weeks ago, if not months ago. And yeah, usually we might pass on a question like this just because it's just like it's like at a conference. They're like, what are the 10 most important, we prefer questions that are a little more specific to a thing rather than give me the 5 most, whatever, Peter, but we did think about it. And I don't want to say we don't love your question because we do. I'm just saying in the future, more specific questions are awesome for Shop Talk Show. Dave, do yours first.
Okay,
yours better than mine.
I got 5. So the first one is my very own Uncle Dave's squeezing crop, which is a way to kind of maintain image hierarchy in when you're resizing a responsive design. Like if you have a really wide image, it looks really small, short, and stubby on a phone when everything's kind of the same size. So I like messing with that. Use a zero height aspect padded div, just like kind of like FitVids or something like that. So it's height 0, padding bottom, whatever, like 56%. And then you use a
back. Which is then based on the width. Because even though it's a padding top, which you'd normally think would be based on height, it's not. It's based on width.
Yeah, so the padding is based on the width, which is pretty sweet. So then you have this aspect ratio box, and then you drop in a background image, like a background size or background image, my cat, and then a background size cover, which means it'll just fill up that whole div. It's pretty awesome. I really like
that. That is pretty cool. Does background size then, like what if you do background position, center, will that affect how cover works?
If you declare
top left and use background size cover, and it behaves a little differently than if you were to center it.
Background size cover will, I think,
override
background position. So, but you have to declare background position before background size, or else it'll pow, it'll blow up on you. So,
boom.
But yeah, so, yeah, and I found that to be really awesome just cause you kind of, sometimes you want images to be taller, you know? And then I'm calling that Uncle Dave's old padded grid or something. Uncle Dave's old padded box. Next one, I like to use nth of type a lot, for everything, lists, anything ever. So I use nth of type a lot. Before and after pseudo elements are rad. And then, Chris, I'm going to steal one of yours. I know you like icon fonts. So I love icon fonts. There you go.
Nice. I like nth of type in there because a lot of times I use nth. I think everybody reaches for nth child just for whatever reason that gets more press or something. And oftentimes an nth of type is a better fit. A lot of times you're like, I want to select the second paragraph on the page. Well, that's great. You usually have in mind exactly which paragraph you want to grab. And then should later it change and, you know, you put like an H1 tag above them or something, all of a sudden you're not selecting the second paragraph anymore. Just because there's this new element that's above it, it's like nth of child paragraph, you know, P nth child 2, you think, God, that's going to grab the second paragraph every time, but it's not. It's going to select the second element, and then if it happens to be a paragraph, then it will select it. You know what I mean? Whereas nth of type, P nth of type 2 is always going to grab that second paragraph. So it's usually more what people have in mind. So I encourage the use of nth of type generally.
Yep. I love it.
My five, one started with image replacement, and it's just the classic because there's just like no website I've ever done in my life practically that doesn't use the, you know, which is like text align -9999 and then setting a width and height and a background image. So you have this box that used to be an H1, but now it's your logo. There's some new revelations in that we could talk about. There was one that's like just set font size to zero zero. That way, which is non-standard. The validator will choke on it, but who cares about the validator, right? It shrinks text down to the point of being invisible, and that way you're not dealing with the problem with text indent -9999 is that it only works when text align is left, and as soon as you happen to align some text the other way, it stops working. And there's some other ways we could talk forever about that, but I'm just saying image replacement is a CSS trick that I use on pretty much every website I've ever done. Like Dave said, icon fonts are so cool. There is a link on CSS tricks that I did a couple days ago on a roundup of all the different icon fonts out there. There's so many of them. It's really kind of a cool way to add icons to your site because images. Just like literally JPEGs or PNGs or whatever, icon fonts can scale. You can just arbitrarily set their color because they're text, so you can just use literally the color property. You know, they're alpha transparent. You can set shadows on them and stuff like that. Really kind of ideal, and it's basically an alternative for spriting. Spriting is another one of my fixes here because it's just a fabulous trick that's all about improving performance. Basically, icon fonts are a form of spriting. It's just instead of loading 50 icons, you know, they're just all in one HTTP request for that font file. Box sizing is a big one for me. Recently, I really like the idea of setting box sizing border box with the star selector on literally everything on the entire site so that you can use percentage widths on everything and then use pixel paddings and margin, or mostly padding, and not worry about, you know, like if you set something to a width of 100% with padding of 20 pixels, really it's 100% plus 40 pixels wide under the normal box sizing model, and that just sucks. I prefer that when I set 100% on a width, I want it to take up 100% of its parent container, and that's it. Don't grow beyond that.
It's kind of like having like a inner container or whatever, container-inner.
It gives you, instead of having to put a div class inside on everything. It fixes that. And of course, the clear fix I consider a CSS trick where you use kind of a pseudo element to append a fake little element that clears floats. So boxes don't collapse that contain only floated elements. That is a bona fide trick that I use all the time. So thanks, Peter. Five tricks that my five favorite tricks, Dave's favorite CSS tricks, in a nutshell. Let's do one by Arthur K, who asked, what's a good solution for HTML5 video streaming? Which I thought I would define quickly as, like, HTML5 video streaming is different than just, like, using the video tag and linking up an HTML5 file. It's all about, you know, like if you're listening to a Steve Jobs talk or whatever that's happening live, so you can kind of link to a source of some kind which just pipes video over as it's happening. So there's things like buffer control and midstream quality adjustments and piping it across with some kind of security. So maybe only people that are authenticated could view this video. So streaming is different than just video as a whole. So Dave, do you know a little bit about this?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can do, like, there are streamers, like, let's say Ustream or Justin TV that do that, but they all do that through Flash typically. When you're watching like the Apple keynote, that's usually streaming through a QuickTime streaming protocol. Mm-hmm. I think it's called RTMP or something.
Which they don't care because this does work on Safari and iOS, right? Are there some kind of support?
Streaming? Yeah.
So, and Apple's like, well, those are the things that we make, so that's what we're going to use.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so it's like a QuickTime plugin there. It's tough, man. There's like, it takes some server hardware and stuff like that. I mean, we do, I was going to say, we do HTML5 audio streaming on the Shop Talk live feed, and it's rad when it works. Like, it'll work on your phone, it'll play in the background on your iPhone or whatever. That it's really rad, but I think video streaming isn't really there yet. So,
So audio is there, but sorry, Arthur, HTML5 video streaming isn't quite there. There is a resource, go to longtailvideo.com/HTML5, where they're kind of tracking the progress of HTML5 video streaming. And it's not looking great.
Yeah. I'll say a prayer at night for the standardization of MP4. But
that would be nice.
All right. Well, okay. We answered that one, right? Boom. Next. Okay. Next one's from Avery Rodden. Avery
Rodden.
Rodden. Sorry. I'm a 17-year-old web developer. I've learned web programming over the past 1.5 years with a focus on back-end programming. Mostly I work with PHP and databases. However, I'd like to monetize my skills when it comes to front-end technology like HTML5, CSS3, jQuery, JavaScript. When I look at the environment and see things ranging from modernizer to icon fonts to responsive design and new specifications, I'm not really sure where to start and what to work on, especially given the ranges of browser support. How would you recommend I modernize my skill and tool sets? As an added plus, how can I do this without spending a bunch of money?
Aha. I'd say this is the most popular question on Shop Talk Show, is that we get, if I had to rate the type of questions we get, is like, I want to get better. How do I do it? What do I focus on? What should I learn next? Very valid questions. Everybody wants to know how to make themselves more valuable. If you're asking yourself these kind of questions, you're already a step ahead of the game, I think, because it just proves that you care. It proves that you're part of the industry. The fact that you sent a question to Shop Talk Show means you like are listening to podcasts in our industry and stuff. So you're already good to go that way. And the second thing that I'll say on every single time someone brings this up, I want to answer it the same way. I want to have, this is going to be my AM radio thing where I'm just like, like, this is my like, dump the MRFer already, or, you know, like everybody, all the pundits of columns and radio shows have this thing where they say over and over, I need a sound bite of some kind. It's going to be like, just build websites or something like that. That was terrible, but I want
good luck.
How's it?
I want it to be like, you don't worry about like what is the exact thing you need to buy a book on next. Just build websites. You have this idea for this website or a client or a personal project you want to work on. Work on that, and the things that you need to learn will come from that naturally, I think. You know, that's a – I don't know. I need a better way to say that so it really does turn into – a soundbite, because I mean that, and I don't think you should force yourself to learn something. You know, be aware of new technologies, but the learning of it should come from a natural cause. I'm sure most of you understand what I'm saying that way. What do you got, Dave?
No, I totally agree. I think, like, if you're building a website, like, that you'll encounter the problems you're, like, supposed to solve. So I like, always think about what it would be like if I started web development, like, right now, if I was, like, 17, like Avery, without all this baggage and crap, I've, like, this cruft of IE hacks I've, like, acquired over the years, like... And so I don't really know. I think your best bet, to try and like, well, your best bet in just like modernizing your skills. I mean, your skills should be pretty modern if you've only been learning it for a year and a half and you do PHP, although that's sort of a different realm, but like, it shouldn't be too hard to pick up this new stuff. If you want to learn like, I guess like, I think you can do that in really easy. There's lots of online courses you can take. So think about that. So yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So,
and, you know, with your idea in mind, I always thought taking a front end course is a great, like the best way to learn is to have this idea for this thing that you want to build and then take a course and then always have that thing that you want to build in your mind as you're taking the course. So everything that they say is like related, like how could I use that, this new thing that I'm learning in my project?
Yep.
Yeah. Cool. And we're going to approach this question every episode, I bet, because people, you know, I want to drill that into people's heads. It's like, what should you learn? Work on your own idea. Or takes, Dave has an interesting note here about, you know, being inspired by somebody else's idea.
And yeah. Well, I was just sort of like making notes or whatever. But if you like, I mean, if you want to like modernize your skill set, like find a site that's really rad. Like let's say like Dribbble or something like that. And don't steal Dribbble because you'll like embarrass yourself and like be shunned from the community forever. But like just on your localhost or whatever, like crack open index.html and just try to like reverse engineer Dribbble or something like that. And you're going to learn so much without like copying and pasting Dan Cederholm's code. Just be like, dude, how do you make that button? Or how do you make it to like when you hover over an image, you just see like this weird, you know, like you're going to teach yourself a lot about design and stuff. If you just try to just emulate, you know, that's, I think you learn by doing. And yeah, so I would just copy, but not steal. Like don't put it on the public internet. That's pretty douchey. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I figure if you start from scratch, yeah, and you're writing code and trying to emulate it, you're going to end up with something different anyway, because there's going to be some of you in there, and that kind of thing. As long as it's not too identical of a copy, can end up on the public.
Yeah, internet. Yeah, yeah.
There's only so many CSS3 buttons you can make. You know?
Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully that was useful. That was Avery Rodden. Just build websites. I'm working on it. I'm working on my sound bite. Yeah.
Next,
Michael Schofield. One of the ways I learn and continue to grow as a web dev is by following blogs and designers like CSS Tricks. Thank you, Michael. NetToots, Paul Irish, Smashing Magazine, etc. ad nauseum. It is like my dad reading newspapers in the morning. Takes forever. I was just enjoying today's 30 Days of jQuery with Jeffrey Way. Jeffrey Way's from NetToots. We've had him on the show before. I started wondering, where does he learn this stuff? I know a lot of knowledge is gained through practice, GitHub collaboration, experimenting, etc., like we just were talking about, building other people's stuff. I bet a lot of us on Shop Talk, a lot of us Shop Talk listeners would like to hear about the blogs, books, designers, etc., that you guys follow. Michael, we do the same thing you do, man. I read me some NetToots and some Paul Irish and some Smashing Magazine. Yeah. We could probably post... You know, like I read more than that. Let's see. What is? I'm just going to read Dave's notes here. Sorry. Dave says he has 176 subscriptions in Google Reader.
I do. Right? I do. But most of them they're not all like web design feeds. They're like friends and photography and stuff like that.
Sure.
But
just good writers.
But yeah. Well, other ones that you didn't mention, I mean, A List Apart is like a standard Like, sure. Think Vitamin is really good, and they'll have the occasional link to like one of their Treehouse videos, which is pretty rad. Or they'll give one away for free. WebKit Bits, which is a blog maintained by David Kaneda. It's really rad. It's like cutting edge stuff. The Viget Labs or Viget Development blog is pretty good, and Web Designer Wall is pretty good. Yeah. So some of those, I got a little beef of some of those. They're not really attributing well. Like they're kind of rehashing somebody's idea, sort of. Anyway, blah, blah, blah.
Drama. That's a good topic we could save. Yeah, that's fun. Maybe we should do like a whole like part of an episode one time that is just about our favorite resources or whatever. But I agree with that. If you're only – I'm sure Michael is reading those too. I mean, maybe not. Maybe he got a few tidbits out of there. But maybe someday we'll just – we'll be like, here's our 20 favorite each or something like that. But yeah, I like Impressive Webs by Lewis Lazarus has been really super good lately. There's this one called like Code Drops or something like that recently that like every article they post has like, and here's a little demo, and there's like 8 variations of that demo that are all like super cutting edge cool CSS3 and JavaScript stuff, and just that's a good one. Code Drops, Impressive Webs. Let me pick one other one. Crack open Google Reader here. It might, you know, it's probably a good idea to follow some browser blogs like the Mozilla Web Dev blog or whatever. They like post stuff that's usually, you know, about Firefox, but you know, they're leading that type of thing too. Following the
HTML5 Weekly is a newsletter thing you sign up for.
It's yeah, pretty I get awesome. That one.
HTML5 Rocks, or is that the Paul Irish one? Or
yeah, I forget which one that is specifically. Anyway, there's so much stuff. Just follow. I don't have any secrets, in other words, Michael. I think we just, you know, and Twitter and stuff. Just, you know, just follow people that you like, and eventually you'll get like you have. We have this kind of morning newspaper of stuff that we read. So you're already doing it right, man. There's no secrets.
You're doing good.
We have another Michael.
I did them all.
Fire.
Okay. Michael McGuire from Vancouver, Washington asks, I tend to use margins and positioning interchangeably in my design, depending on whichever feels better for a particular element, which leads to inconsistent design, which in turn bugs me. I'm starting to think that it's best practice, or that the best practice would be to have the wrapper be relative, the sections be absolute positioned, and the elements inside the sections be relatively positioned with margins. Okay. Hopefully that made sense to everyone. How do you gentlemen feel about position-based layout in general? What are your preferences in using margins versus positions, and do you have guidelines when you're choosing positions?
I can understand this being confusing a bit. I did a screencast recently on the different position values. So if you have no idea what CSS positioning, what the different ones are, and when and why and how and what happens when you use those different ones, you could check that out. I guess I'll link that up. But he's saying the first part of this is he uses margins and paddings interchangeably. That, you know, it makes sense because it kind of pushes things away. They are rather similar. You know, there's margin top and padding top, and they both kind of add space above whatever is in that container. They are different, of course. If you're working in like a white on white, and you know, like you just crack open a document and you have no CSS applied to it at all, and you write a paragraph element and you give margin top to that paragraph, it's going to behave pretty much the same way as if you added padding top to that thing. But it's different in that it affects the box model differently. If that paragraph element had a red background and you added margin top, above that paragraph is going to be white because you're pushing it away, like the box isn't getting any bigger. You're just pushing that box away from the box above it. Whereas padding, it would be red above that paragraph because you're extending the size of the box of the paragraph. So as soon as you have different backgrounds on things, you'll start understanding better or stop you know, using those two things interchangeably, because they are different. One affects like the internal box model and margin, while it's still part of the box model, kind of pushes away the content in kind of a different way. And then he's talking about, I've started to think that the best practice is to have the wrapper be relative and the sections be absolutely positioned. That's just too broad and generic without talking about a specific layout. I would never tell you that having a relative wrapper and absolutely positioned sections in it is absolutely the best layout technique in every situation. In fact, it seems a little weird and less common to me than not, you know, absolutely positioned stuff is awesome. I think Dave agrees with me there.
Totally.
It's kind of underused, possibly. Absolutely positioning things within relative position context is very powerful and cool and useful and possibly underused. But absolute positioning an entire section of content is probably not super common, because I just think of a section as like having articles in it and text and stuff that can grow and needs to push the page around and kind of be a part of the page flow.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, anyway.
Yeah, that's kind of where I use margins when I want like space in between two elements, like a margin, you know. I use position when I want to be like aggressive and really like fix something on some coordinates, you know. Which when you're using, I do a lot of responsive design, that's no secret, but it, like when you do that, you can't really, you can't guarantee verticality. So I wouldn't really use vertical, you know, any absolute positioning for vertical stuff, maybe left and right. So I tend to use margin in most cases, margins and floats. And then, I almost never use margin top. I'll always use padding. If like you're, difference between padding and margins is getting weird, but I hardly ever use margin top. I'll always margin down as I go through my document. And then, margin and positional behavior.
Well, if you mix those up, know that two blocks on top of each other, if one has 50 pixels of margin bottom and the other one has 50 pixels of margin top, do you, as a quick test, how much space is in between those two blocks? And the answer is 50 pixels, because margins that hit each other, that touch each other like that, top and bottom, they collapse.
Yeah.
So it'll just squish down to the tallest one of those two margins. So that can be a little confusing. You know, there's reasons for why it does that, but that can be rather confusing. Whereas paddings never collapse.
Yeah.
So,
you just got to be careful what you do. But like in terms of absolute position, I usually just do that in like a fixed element, like let's say, or like a widget, let's say like a rotator, image rotator. I want text at the bottom. I'll absolute position that text. So I don't really use like positioning for layout that much. So because it's pretty aggressive. I just think of it as really aggressive. It's almost like the important of layout.
We're trying our best here, but it's pretty hard to talk super generically about the best positioning techniques. You know, it's so much easier to talk about when we have a layout in front of us and we can point at things.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, cool.
Casey Olson. We got another
call in.
Boom. Compass Casey Olson, what do you got for us?
Here we go.
Compass and Sass help us write better CSS more easily. The Lemonade update added powerful spriting abilities that stretched Compass out of a simple Sass to CSS converter with a lot of really useful mix-ins into something much more powerful. I'm starting to think there's a similar need for HTML. Here are some examples. Reset style sheets start with a large list of obscure elements, but if I don't have a definition list or summary in my markup, resetting it is wasteful. I would find a tool that scans my HTML and resets only the elements I use very useful. Of course, if I added a block quote and then compiled, it would be in the new outputted reset. Another example would be code highlighting and, sorry Dave, lettering JS. What if instead on the client's computer or phone, it spans around each letter in related CSS? were added on the development machine, or maybe server-side. I think a tool like this would help designers and developers use best practices that at the moment are far too tedious to be considered best practices. Do you think this is a good idea? Could it fit into Compass? Should I learn Ruby?
Okay.
So much stuff there. What do you got?
So he has like two parts, just like server-side like code generation, and then that was the second one, like lettering, and then the first one was like a CSS reset sniffer.
Yeah, like not using the stuff that you don't need. And that's relevant to JavaScript as well. I think I've heard some pretty cool stuff that Chrome is doing that's like it can see what JavaScript will run and not run. So if you have this function in your JavaScript that just is never called, it just won't even serve it, which is kind of amazing. But it's the same kind of thing. He's saying, like, if you reset a block quote, but there's no block quotes in your HTML, why have, you know, block quote margin zero, padding zero, or whatever in there? It's like extra stuff that you'll never need.
Yeah. So I think this idea would be awesome, like a sniffer resetter, but that only works if you have like a static system. Like if you have user generated content in a CSS, like it's like, you would have to then recompile your CSS every time.
Remember that CSS isn't just one page. Even in this user-generated content, your CSS file, probably especially your global one, affects every single page on your entire site. So the sniffer would need to go through every page on the entire that it touches, which is almost impossible to know.
Mm-hmm. So, like,
is weird.
I think the Boy Scout motto, always be prepared, is probably the best thing here. Like if you have a block quote style, like a base block quote style, it's, you're talking like, I don't know, 30 bytes of
right. You know, CSS. We're talking about micro optimization here, which is just not the best use of your time. There's, I really like, this isn't quite the time and place for it, but there's like, we could list five things. You know, we could say minification of JavaScript, CSS, and concatenation. We could say spriting. We could say setting your proper htaccess header. There's five things that you can do that will, each of them will be 100 times more important than worrying about a block quote style that's mm-hmm. unused in your CSS. There's things that are just many orders of magnitude more important than that. And I was saying it's not important to think about. It's kind of a clever idea that you brought up, but it's just micro optimization should be at the bottom of the list of those things. Is that fair?
Totally agree. And then so his second part is the server-side, like server-side version of lettering. There actually is one called Rack Lettering, which is for Ruby. It's like basically you can trigger lettering on the server side, so the client doesn't have to do that. It's cool, but I mean, I think I like the idea of lettering being client. I mean, I made it, so whatever. it's cool. But
disclaimer.
Disclaimer. Let's do close enough. Disclaimer. I'm a little involved in it. No. I think it's client side. So I feel like you should have the ability to inject it or strip it out, you know? So yeah, I would never call lettering a best practice. Lettering is just a step on the way to nth everything, please. So, but yeah, I think like there's a lot of stuff you could do stuff on this.
I see. That sounds fair to me. I can see both sides of this because on one hand, the way that lettering works now is that those spans aren't there when the page loads, and the CSS might load and might affecting that letter before the JavaScript does. And then all of a sudden, lettering kicks in and it puts the spans around those letters and new CSS takes place, right? So there's some ways to fight against flash of not awesome text, right? So I'm sure that you dealt with that in the past.
Yeah.
But still, it there is this little jump. And if you insert the spans on the server side, it will be a little faster. You won't have to deal with those problems. And you could build it into a CMS. You know, you could build it in Ruby and output it or whatever. I can see the argument there. And I also can see the argument of at some point we're going to have Nth Letter. It's kind of imminent at this point, and keep in, and then that's just, it's going to work the same way, only it's going to be built into CSS, so there also won't be this flash event. So keeping it on the client so you can just strip it out, it's easier to strip out something like lettering.js than it is to strip out like a server-side component, I guess.
Yeah, and my goal with lettering, I mean, this isn't like the lettering podcast or anything, but like my goal for lettering was just like for you to have maintainable markup, which something like a middleware like Rack Lettering would give you that, but I don't think you want like a boom. You don't want your markup that you're working on to be just filled with spans and crap. That was my main reason for not just hard coding spans. So.
That's a weird gray area, you know, because someone would say, well, I don't know, you know, like.
It's weird.
The spans are getting in there one way or another, so.
That's true. So, anyway, not a bad idea. I think you can do it, but I don't know if it. Yeah, we'll
and
see.
Be aware, Casey, that there are preprocessors for. He's kind of saying, like, I'm aware of CSS preprocessors, but does HTML need a preprocessor? There are a variety of HTML preprocessors already. They don't do what you are talking about per se, and all the sniffing type of stuff. But there are ones that make writing HTML a bit easier. I haven't dabbled. I've used a number of them, but I often find they're less useful than the CSS ones. But there are things like Haml, Slim. And Jade are the three big ones that I'm aware of. Anyway, so just know that they exist. We have two intercombined questions about, unfortunately, one of my least favorite topics, but we'll get through it because it is an important topic despite it being my least favorite. Mark, neither of these are audio, so we kind of have to explain both of them. I'll try to do it as quick as I can. Mark Lurs says, I was reading the box sizing post, and I've seen a little conversation going about IE7 dying faster than IE6. I would have to say that this is pretty accurate. I work for a servicing agency that does all Ford and Lincoln digital and traditional over the last few years, and we've been fighting to support IE6. The big issue was that Ford, their corporate office, was still on IE6 for a very long time. So just for that reason, just because these people that worked at Ford had IE6 on their computer, that they had to support IE6. So once they decided to jump away, these people that worked at Ford, from IE6 to IE8, and trust me, they were slow when they did that, apparently, he says here. I had a conversation with one of their IT guys about why they did it, and they said IE8 would provide the longest support. So he's like, these IT guys were saying that we could have jumped to IE7, but he's saying we want to be stuck. we don't want to do this again, so we're going to move to IE8. Which just sucks. Like, really, if that's your reason, you should have at least moved to 9. Anyway, and so he's moving. They're moving to Windows 7 with IE8 and whatever. And because of that, now literally on the Ford and stuff websites, they can up their minimum support, whatever. Okay, so he says, I have a friend that works at an agency that supports GM Chevy, and they basically did the same thing, and now have to support only IE8. And he's just saying, from his experience, especially in this corporate world, that people are jumping past IE7, and then IE7 is going to die faster than IE6. And then I have another question by Dave Kelly. More succinct, he just says, IE7, the W3C school guys say only 3% use it. Should we still focus on making our sites compatible in this browser? What's the deal? Is IE7 going to die faster than IE6?
I would say, yes, it will. But it's an interesting deal. So Paul Irish blogged about how, like, there's like this enterprise level of Microsoft, which is what Mark was talking about, and how I think Microsoft guarantees a 10-year lifespan of all software, whether their whole software suite for enterprise corporations, including IEs. So we'll be supporting like IE7 and 8. IE6, I think, has been sunsetted for the most part, but we'll be supporting IE7 and 8 for a while now. IE8, I feel like, is going to be around for the longest time, since a lot of people are still on XP, which is the best browser you can have on that system.
And then, is that the case?
Yeah. And then just like, well, and he was saying Windows 7 IE8, which that's really interesting because Windows 7 should support IE9 by default, but I guess they're downgrading it to 8.
I wonder if you go buy it. I wonder if somebody could write in. I wonder if you go buy it from the store today, literally just like walk into a Circuit City, or those don't even exist anymore, do they? Some kind of store that sells internet stuff. And you walk out with a copy of Windows in your hand on a DVD or whatever. I don't know if you can even do that anymore. But does it come with 8 or 9?
I think it'll come with 9. Maybe I'll do that. I'll take this up.
Use our Shop Talk Show gold yeah, diamond American.
Our pot of gold.
accept gold and coins?
That's Circuit City. I'll travel back in time and go buy one. I think we'll be supporting it for a while. Interesting, Dave Kelly.
I think so, but I think they say this is going to come out soon. Is that you know how Safari updates? It updates through software update on OS X. So I have one literally on my screen right now. Let me hit show details. I have to update Java for OS X, which is like, okay, go ahead, dude. But that's how your Safari updates come down too. If there's a new version of Safari, it's built into the software update tool of OS X. All the rest of the browsers have their own update mechanism. This is how, theoretically, it's going to work for IE. It hasn't in the past, but they're going to put it in that, their little Microsoft Update Tuesdays or whatever the heck they are. That's how IE updates are going to come. And you have to opt out of that. I think it's going to be by default opt-in. So it's even IE8 will be shorter, too. I mean, we talked about IE6 forever. I hope that both IE7 and IE8 combined, I hope we'll talk about for less time.
Yeah. Well, in like the new IEs, IE9 and then what I've like seen on whatever the verge of IE10, it's going to be really good. I mean, I think the case for moving forward is going to be better, like way good. So,
I can't wait. I really am excited about IE10. I have been updating the wufoo.com/html5, which is almost done. It's not, I wish I could tell you it's out, but it's just a really lot of research I did on HTML5 forms, and it hasn't been updated in a little while. Like, I don't even know how long. It hasn't been a year, but it's been long enough. And there's been a lot happening in browsers, and I'm going through, and I'm marking a lot of stuff green. There's not as much as I would like. There's still some weird stuff, but IE10 across the board just supports everything. It's just HTML5 form stuff. And it's not even just form stuff. It's like supports. It might be, and I wonder if other browsers are stepping it up and making sure this isn't the case. But at some point, it was seeming like when IE10 comes out, it's going to be better, literally like better than Chrome, as far as like running down the checklist of what HTML5 CSS3 stuff it supports. It was going to be better than anything, Opera, Chrome, Firefox, whatever. It's gonna take the lead, which is crazy.
How do you feel about that? IE7 has less than 3%, so we shouldn't use it.
That stat is global. First of all, it's from W3 Schools, which is automatically irrelevant. Second of all, the only stat that matters are the sites on your own site. So website. Only base things based on that. Also, you've linked up Stat Counter here, which is better. Use that. And God, what else was I going to say about that?
I was just going to say, like, IE7's browser share is like greater than Safari for iPad, and it's about the same as Safari. So, like, using your logic based on like percentage of supports, like, would you drop support for the iPad, like, just because? Like,
no, but that's growing and this is shrinking. So
fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, yeah, I guess trend wise, but it's just, I just for me, it's just like, in most clients I've had,
I hate cracking that out for mobile too. Literally less, it's like 0.04% of CSS tricks traffic is mobile. Okay. Does that mean I should not have a mobile website? And I'm like, no, because I like making mobile websites. And that number is – it's weird on CSS Tricks because it's a reference and you're not writing code on your phone usually. So you don't need to Google CSS Tricks. And I'm sure that's why the thing is there though. But I don't know. It's just a weird situation. Literally some websites – isn't it like Facebook is like higher than 50% of all their traffic is mobile? That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's insane. So, yeah, I mean, In my experience, it hasn't been too hard to support these IEs. So I mean, unless you're doing something really radical, good luck.
About the other day, where I have a good chunk, we're definitely still supporting i7. It's a big chunk.
Like I've seen a lot of companies, they still have i7 kind of greened out in their little support matrix. So
we're gonna try and get through four more here, people.
Let's go fast.
I think our plan was we kind of both me and Dave made little notes in here. So I was like, if we make notes, it'll be faster. And I think it's actually making us slower because we're like, I have lots to say about
it. I wrote a diary on it. all right. Next, Ash Robbins is asking about jQuery. Is there a reason why so many sites and tutorials always use the Google CDN version of jQuery instead of referencing the latest version from the jQuery.com? Example, Ajax APIs, jQuery 1.7.1, jQuery JS. You guys have seen it. You guys are all web developers. Surely with the above, you'll have to constantly make sure your version of jQuery is up to date as opposed to below code.jquery.com/jQuery latest.js. Ash is asking, shouldn't you just use the latest one to always have the latest? Chris, you know
there's
this.
There's different parts to this story. One is, why do we do this at all? Why do we link to not a local copy, but we link to the Google copy? Well, one reason is Google servers are wicked fast. We've been doing this for years and years, linking to their copy of jQuery, and it's like never failed us. You can write a fallback if you want, but I usually hardly even do that anymore because it's always up and it's always super fast. And if you visit, like CSS Tricks uses this, if then you go to another site which uses this, it because it's the same URL, it will be cached. So then it doesn't have to download anything at all, which makes your site all the faster for doing it. So that's one of the reasons, CDN being a content delivery network. It's specifically like there might be a server in my backyard where I'm getting this from, because that's what CDNs are all about, is having like local copies of this stuff. Anyway, so you've seen the URLs before, like when it links to Google to grab jQuery. And part of that URL is something like 1.7.1, which references the exact version of jQuery that you're trying to link to. If you want to benefit from the caching, which is a big part of this, you have to link to a ... of that. Like 1.7.1 is the only one that has the proper caching headers for this, which is like a year or something like that, because that's not going to change. If you link to just 1.7 or just /1, which will give you the latest version of jQuery, you will get the latest version of jQuery, but it won't be cached as well, so you don't get any of those benefits, which is too bad. The other part of this question is why link to it from Google when jQuery.com offers the same thing? You can. I think it might just DNS redirect it. They have a CDN now too. They're not discouraging you from doing that like they used to. You can link to it from jQuery.com. That is okay. It's less popular, so you get less of the caching thing again. And the second part of this is all about breaking stuff. So Dave has some info on that.
Yeah, well, so I've used jQuery like /1/jQuery.js in the past. But I was told by jQuery team members, don't do that because we might stop using the dollar sign. Like, and I was just like, gasp! I had like a moment.
You're kind of kidding. I doubt they would drop the dollar sign, but that's the kind of changes they have the right to make.
Right. So like that would – like I don't think they'll make that change now. Or at least in like /1, because that change would be catastrophic for the whole entire internet. Like the internet would fall over. But just be aware, beware, big changes like that could happen because it's their code, it's their thing. And like if a jQuery team member is like saying, don't do that, don't do that. Bada bing, bada boom.
It's just too dangerous. If you link to 1.7.1, that will never change. So if your code works with it, you'd never have to worry about it. It will just work forever. But if you link to the latest, that will change. And there's some advantages to that because a lot of times jQuery will change and it will be faster. It will like be better in some way. They almost all their updates make some kind of something faster. So you get those advantages, but you also get that potential that it could break. And believe me, it does. Once in a while, if I go back through CSS Tricks in every single demo and just go to like an old demo from 2 years ago, and I just go and I've been doing using the Google CDN for jQuery for so long, I just be like, oh, this is linking to 1.4.3 or whatever. I'll just change it to 1.7.2 now or whatever, and then load that demo again. Once in a while, it'll just not work. Be like, dang it. Usually it's related to plugins, which have deeper kind of dependencies and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you go grab the latest version of that plugin and it has updated itself and starts working or whatever. But, you know, it happens. So if you're, especially if you're loading an application that people like literally users use, don't link to the latest. Link to a steady version.
Totes.
Dimitri Felchua. I keep forgetting. I should do more pause. See that then you do the gunshot, and then I say the name, and there's like a better distinct.
Oh, it's fine. I think you just ignore it, and you, it's just like we're out hunting, and I'm just
shooting. Broken the fifth wall.
Yeah, you broke the wall. You broke the fourth wall, Chris.
I really screwed that up. Looking right at you, audience.
We should probably like go to improv classes and really step up our game. I'm gonna make a note. We're gonna use our pot of gold on improv classes.
Cool. I went to a bar camp once that had a really good improv intro to it. It was awesome. Going to Minneapolis this weekend for their bar camp, in which like 2,000 people come to or some crazy thing like that.
Whoa,
it's enormous.
Danger.
If there's an improv class, I'll go and then I'll reteach it to you over Skype. I know that you're supposed to do yes and, so you'd be like,
yes,
I drive a dump truck. And then you go, yes, and you wear purple trousers. And I go, yes, and I have a gun. And he goes, yes, and don't kill me. You know, you have to like build on their story instead of saying, no, but you don't really have a gun. You have a flower, because that like screws
that
up the story
it.
And it doesn't here, flow as well.
Here, let's try it real quick. Chris,
okay.
I just realized I haven't been recording.
Yeah. Oh, damn it.
No, I'm just kidding.
I was so off track by that because that makes me sad. I'm going to miss my flight.
That would be funny. Okay, let's go to Dimitar. He said, hi, guys. Great show. My question is, if you want to start a personal blog and write about front-end development, what platform will you choose, WordPress or Tumblr? Oh, WordPress Tumblr showdown. Let's go. Let's do that. I can do this. So I love WordPress, and there are ways around it, but the Tumblr editor, where you type in stuff in Tumblr, is pretty small and miserable for like long form posts about code. In sure. That's IMHO. And so if I were going to start I'd probably do WordPress because you can do a lot of cool, like, it's just, I think it's better suited for like longer posts and stuff like that. If I were going to start what's that? Yeah, the editor and just even the plugins are easier to get going, blah, blah, blah. If I were going to start a blog today, I would probably look at static site generators, but that's a different topic entirely. Yada, yada, yada. Chris?
Yeah, well, when he said Tumblr, I was like, okay, so you're talking about a hosted platform because there is no self-install Tumblr.
Right.
So when he said WordPress or Tumblr, I was like, okay, WordPress.com or Tumblr.com. WordPress.com meaning the self-hosted – or not the not self-hosted, the hosted version of WordPress. In that case – if you're comparing those two things, Tumblr actually has better customizability, I think. You can even run your own custom JavaScript on a Tumblr site, which I'm pretty sure you can't on a WordPress.com site. WordPress.com has fewer themes, I think, that are nice, but fewer. And if you want to customize it, I think it's now a paid add-on to get access to edit the CSS for WordPress.com, which I think do for free on Tumblr. Not totally sure, though. Anyway, I'm just saying those are comparing the hosted version. But I'm saying because you're writing about front-end web development, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to want to not have this be hosted. at some point. You're going to want to install WordPress and use WordPress on your own domain so that you can do whatever the heck you want. No more limitations and paying for add-ons and that type of thing. And in that case, I definitely recommend WordPress, and that it will be much easier for you to export what you've already done on WordPress.com and import it into a WordPress.org site. You could probably do that in Tumblr, but I think it'll just be cleaner moving from WordPress to WordPress. Anyway, I like WordPress better, and you should pick WordPress.
Ta-da. Okay, boom. I'm going to call that one done. Next one is from Mr. Tim Mays, and I think we have an MP3 here.
Hey, guys. I'm curious to know where you get some pure code review. I'm an only child developer at my place of employment.
I like that.
On the East Coast. It gets lonely, and I'm always looking for people to talk shop with. I do spend some time on forums and blogs, but I'm looking for something more engaging, like user groups and conferences. Do you know of any cool hangout spots on the East Coast for awesome, sweet developers?
Well, there's tons. I'm very Texas Coast, but I get all my peer review from friends I've made at meetups and conferences. I would say the East Coast hangouts that I know of. I wish I knew what city you're in. I could have looked up more, but I know in Boston you have Boston RB, Refresh Boston. New York, I've heard good things about NYCJS. There's also, I think, a Dribbble meetup in New York that's pretty rad. DC has the DC Ruby Users Group, I've heard good things about. I think in Baltimore has Be More on Rails. I think both of those cities have pretty rad. Oh, Capital JS is in DC. It's pretty rad. Philly, there's Philomade, which is more like for creatives, but still the same audience. And Refresh Philly, man, yeah.
There's a huge WordPress meetup in DC. I know that's kind of weekly, I think. Maybe not weekly. I'm not sure. Monthly. Anyway, yes. See, so those are the type of things he's talking about. Refresh events. He's talking about. I'm talking about WordPress. Just any kind of meetup. I literally use the internet and look for these things because they're out there and there's a lot of them. And then they'll probably be that one will find you more. Like if I know there's a Barcamp Philly. I know there's a Barcamp New York City. I think the Barcamp tour is coming to both of those things, which I'm a part of. So let's say you're in New York, and let's say you go to a bar camp. You're going to meet some people that are pretty cool. Even if you don't have the best time of your life at that bar camp, you're going to hear about other events at that bar camp probably. You might go to that other event, and you might see some of the same people that were at bar camp, and then you'll be like, automatically can have like an in to talk with them because you're like, oh, dude, I saw you at bar camp too. Whatever. Go to there are these things, especially on the East Coast where you say you are, dude, there's stuff to go to. You just got to kind of Google around for it, and I'm sure you can find something.
I think there should be like JavaScript meetups, refreshes, and
start
all
your own
majors. Yeah. Whatever you like to do, just look for it on meetup.com, and it works. It works.
I know you have the need for it, though. Do you know, like you're literally an only child developer. That's great. Don't be that anymore.
No.
If you got to start your own, just do it.
And then also, yeah, hang out. Find an IRC chat or something you like. That's a good way to, It's like whatever your interest is in, Tim. There's a community around that, I think. So big time. Do that.
Last one.
John from John Imperio.
This is John Imperio. I'm originally a graphic designer, but now I'm mostly into front-end web design and development. In regard to one of last week's question, where Anthony Edinger has 15 years of experience, well, in my case, I don't have that kind of experience. So for someone like me who started late into web design and development, I definitely have a lot of catching up to do. For the past 2 years, I've familiarized myself with PHP through using WordPress. I'm into jQuery and recently started to adapt HTML5 and CSS3. So my question is, what should I be focusing on to keep up with the industry? Thank you.
Just build websites! I'm working on my website.
That's not the right one.
This is the same question as earlier. I told you we get a lot of these, right? What do I focus on? Totally legitimate question. He's using a lot of these technologies, dabbling around with them. Which one would benefit his career the most to focus on the most? First, John, get an idea in mind. Bill, try to build that idea. You know, just let the technologies come to you, sir.
Mm-hmm. I would say if you're coming from like a graphic design background, I think learning JavaScript could never hurt. And I mean that in the beyond like jQuery, or at least have that aha moment, which that's like synergy because it relates to Chris's blog here. But what, like, kind of figure out JavaScript, what it's doing. You know, don't just chuck a bunch of plugins at a situation. Like, figure out what it's doing. Because then especially if you're a graphic designer, you'll be able to like really craft sweet JavaScript and CSS transitions and animations that would be the most awesome for your profession and your life and your website. So that's my opinion.
I can't, buddy.
Knowing JavaScript's
always definitely. If you have some front end skill and you don't know any JavaScript and you're asking us this question, what to focus on next, that's definitely what you need to learn. It's very hard, I think, in today's world to be a front-end developer and totally stay away from JavaScript. You might as well bite the bullet and get into it a little bit. What Dave was talking about was a post on CSS Tricks called the JavaScript Aha Moment, which is people sharing their own moment in which the feeling of understanding washed over them with JavaScript. And in some way, that happened to me with jQuery because jQuery is JavaScript, which is a kind of a whole conversation unto itself. I know it has a different syntax and stuff, but what you're writing literally is JavaScript that is parsed by the browser, whereas like CoffeeScript is not JavaScript. It compiles into JavaScript. Anyway, that's definitely where to go next if you need to learn JavaScript or whatever, but also just build websites. Take your idea. And, one of the sponsors of CSS Tricks called Treehouse, run by a bunch of great guys. I'm a fan of it. They're not sponsoring the show at all. They sponsor CSS Tricks. They would be nice if they would, actually. Anyway, if you have that idea in mind, you know, part of my Just Build Websites mantra, get that idea in mind and then maybe go take a course on Treehouse and see what up.
No, that's a good. Yeah, it's literally if once you're building, like you have an idea that you want to build out or a website you're building, like you can go down so many rabbit holes, like just that are month long journeys into SVG or something like that. You know, like you just get yourself into some trouble, and that's the best way to learn. Like learn by failing. That's my advice.
Learn well, by failing.
Boom.
That brings us to a wrap.
Yep.
Week's rapid fire show. I hope you enjoyed that, folks. We got through more questions than we normally do on a thing. So we're going to do this once in a while to catch up. And hopefully if you send a question, you will hear your name on either a regular show with our guests, if it happens to be a good question for that guest or something that is along the lines of their expertise, or if it's a more generic question, it might end up on one of our rapid fire.
It's failing. Okay.
Shows. Any final words, Dave?
No, well, we really appreciate you guys. Follow us on iTunes at Shop Talk Show and vote us up in iTunes. We'd love that. We'd love that. Go totally. Do that.
Give us a rating with the star thingy.
Go do that.
Anyway, shoptalkshow.com.